Born in 1952, Martin Parr is a British documentary photographer, photojournalist, and photo book collector. He is known for photo projects that take an intimate, satirical, and anthropological look at aspects of modern life, in particular documenting the social classes of England and more broadly the wealth of the Western world. Major projects have included rural communities, the last resort, the cost of living, small world, and common sense. The Martin Parr Foundation was founded in 2014 in Bristol, England, and houses his archive, his collection of British and Irish photography by other photographers, and a gallery. His work explores the difference between mythology and the reality of places. His photo book, A History, in 3 volumes, covers more than 1,000 examples of photo books from the 19th century to the present day. He continues to discover new important books all the time. We met virtually over Zoom to talk first about collecting books. Okay, well, I want to start with book collecting first. You as a book collector, if I may, how did you get into collecting?
Well, I was a photographer first. And of course, if you're a photographer, you're interested in what other photographers have done. So from an early age, when I was at college many years ago, I started collecting books. But this is accelerated as an idea probably in the late 1980s, when I had some extra cash from my profession, and this enabled me to go out and buy a book in a much serious manner.
Sorry?
I finished that sentence.
Yeah, it didn't sound like you, it got cut off just the end of it.
Oh dear. I'm surprised we're breaking up, because it sounds good to me.
Okay. We'll just go with that then. What specifically did you go for and why?
I guess you started to collect the iconic books about photography that we knew about, because they are, if you like, our terms of reference. And then, of course, started to discover that there are a lot more books out there that hadn't really been sought after, or hadn't really been collected, or hadn't been recognized. So I started to collect them as well. I went beyond the usual places where people collect, which is Europe and America, and went to other territories like China, Japan, Latin America, Australia, New Zealand, and started to get very intrigued by the whole history of photography that was revealed through the photographic books.
Okay, so there were iconic books that were recognized. So what did you see that made the additional books you went after iconic in your mind?
I think they were very good photography, but they hadn't been recognized. I mean, there are certain things like the famous photographers like Walker Evans, Robert Frank, William Klein that we all knew about, but then it soon transpired that there are many other books out there which were as good and as important, which hadn't really had the due attention they deserved. So you suddenly realized, as there is no particular history of photography books that have been developed, that you're onto something that was very exciting.
That's exactly what great collectors do. They identify areas that are undervalued or ignored and develop them.
Yes, I mean, I hadn't thought of it in that way, but I suppose when you mention it like that, I can't really disagree. And, you know, you felt you're on a voyage of discovery. And I remember going to Japan in particular, who had a very active time in the 60s and 70s producing photography books of the highest standard. And I find it amazing that we didn't know about these books over in Europe and America. And when you got to Japan and started to see them, you understood how good they were and how robbed we had been of not having a chance to enjoy and understand and appreciate these remarkable achievements in photographic publishing.
Were they undervalued monetarily? Like, were you able to pick them up relatively inexpensively?
Well, in Japan, they have a very developed market for photography books. So they weren't giving them away. They were pricey, but they're a lot cheaper than they're worth now. Because since the Western collector has got onto them, the prices have gone up. But they had before there, you know, they had catalogs of photography books. They knew much more than we did what they're onto and how good they were. So they're ahead of the game, if you like to put it like that.
What made them so good?
It was a combination of a very strong imagery with very strong sense of design. In Europe and America, the designer books was much more conventional. You know, you have a double white page spread, maybe a picture on the right. In Japan, they're exploring full bleeds. They're exploring a combination of black and white and color, adventurous design, all kinds of things. So the photographers there would often hand their images over to a designer, and the designer would come up with the book. While as here, we almost had a formula that was stuck to, and although some of the pictures were very good, every book more or less looked the same in terms of how it appeared, in terms of the design concept.
Even though a lot of them were self-published over here.
Well, there weren't so many self-published. There are a few. I mean, the self-published age really came about in the last 20 years since we've had digital printing. And now, of course, there are many more books published, you know, on things like print-on-demand services like Blurb than there would be published as books. But back in those days, some of those Japanese books were self-published, but a lot more relationships with established publishers.
Okay, so you're saying that most of the earlier books, say Western world books, were published by publishers rather than the photographers themselves?
Correct. I mean, there are a few exceptions, but generally speaking, there was much fewer, of course, published back then in the 40s, 50s, 60s to what there are now. I mean, now there must be 2,000 to 3,000 photography books published every year. Most of them, of course, slip through the net and are forgotten very quickly, but some do really hit the button and become very iconic and very collectible. And that, of course, is where the prices go up and indeed where you may even get a second edition.
I'd be surprised with those books back in the 60s and 70s if even 5 to 10% of them were underwritten completely by the publishers.
Well, I don't actually know the economics of it, but I don't see why they wouldn't be underwritten by the publishers. I mean, these days you have a lot of photography book publishers who'd ask the photographer for a contribution. But back in those older days, the 40s to the 60s, I've never heard of that actually happening. I mean, I'm not saying it didn't, but it wasn't the expected normality. I think the publishers just took the risk and would publish the books.
Well, a lot of the publishing was connected to museums, though, and they were the ones that would underwrite the cost of the catalogs, correct?
Well, yes, there are books published by the likes of Museum of Modern Art. But I would say it's not going to be much more than, say, 10% that were published by museums. I mean, much more so in America and thus, I assume, Canada than perhaps in Europe.
Hmm.
Remember, these are two very different markets in terms of photography.
Yeah. So did you start off kind of with a big wide net and then slowly narrow it, or was it always wide?
I mean, it was always wide. And the more you dig and the more you delve, the more you realize how much there is out there and how much we haven't covered and how ignorant we had been in, you know, the classic Western study centers of photography like Europe and America. To the actual achievements of other territories, particularly areas like China and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very exciting, as I mentioned before, to go on this discovery and to find these books and to dig them out. And you have to remember, much before 1999, which is when the first photography book about books came out, which is Fotografía Pública, published in Spain in 1999, there had been no real serious studies of photography books. It's not like an established market, say, like first editions of novels, where obviously that, if you like, is the sort of leader in how the photography market, if you like, followed those first edition of novels and thus became quite valuable, especially with the classic things like association copies, signed first editions, the stuff that I'm sure you're very familiar with. And your listeners to your podcast.
What about the antiquarian book dealer Andrew Roth, who came out with
That was the second book, 101 Photography Books, which came out a few years later after the Spanish one. And you know, that was because the Spanish one would not have had much exposure in America. That, I guess, in America was a thing that kicked the market off there as being a sort of collectible thing. So it really had a big impact. And then ours came a few years after our volumes 1 and 2, which came out in 2004, 2005, or 2006. You know, we were a bit later on in the market. So the Andrew Roth book was indeed very important as well.
Yeah, and I've heard it argued that your books were, in effect, a kind of a response to his book. His book being sort of an antiquarian book market analysis, you know, or codification of these books, whereas yours is much more of a kind of an idiosyncratic subjective view of what should be recognized.
Well, he was a dealer, remember, and he was big mates with Glenn Howitch, who is one of the prime movers in that whole market of antiquarian books. And if you like, the 101 books that he published was almost like a hardback catalogue of what he was selling.
Yeah.
I guess we weren't doing that. You know, both Jerry Badger and myself were photographers, and we were looking at it from the point of view of being a photographer and what inspired us.
Yeah.
And that's why we would consider our books, if you like, to be more like a revisionist history. History of photography, like the history of anything, is very subjective. It's constantly shifting and changing. And we were adding in, if you like, many books and many territories that have been overlooked into this history, because we felt that history, you know, emanating from the colleges and the professors and the curators of Europe and America were somewhat, you know, arrogant in thinking that they knew everything and they didn't really take seriously the rest of the world. So our job, if you like, was to try and redress that balance.
Well, yours is from a practitioner's perspective.
Yes, absolutely. And also to do with the, you know, trying to recognize that the photo book didn't have the status it deserved, even within contemporary photography. Since then, our books and other people who've made these books, you know, have really, if you like, turned that market around. And now there's a much more healthy, advanced marketplace for collecting photography books, and nearly every country of any significance has now got its own history of photo books. Japan, Germany, Holland, France. There are now, you know, I have a shelf here with 20, 30 books about the history of photo books. So it's become a much more recognized field. This is only quite recent, so it's quite interesting, I guess. I mean, you know, you're someone that's interested in books. There must be other histories of different genres of books that you've explored. And I imagine photography books hasn't really come into your radar much until, well, obviously today is the exception to that.
Well, I have a good friend who has a huge collection, and I've known him for quite a while, so I am aware of the importance of them. But yeah, as far as this podcast goes, I was only made aware of you not that long ago, so I'm very happy to have found you and your books. They're I'd say, really, they're a testament to you as a collector, because, correct me if I'm wrong, you developed a wonderful collection and then you decided to take the time to study it and add to the general knowledge by producing these books. Is that correct?
I guess that's a summary of it. I mean, Jerry wrote the text. I edited the books with him. We decided and sat down together which books should be included. And I don't know if you know, I mean, this is an important part of the story, but about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, these books, my main collection, went to the Tate. They acquired it for a very good price. They had just discovered the pleasures of photography in the last 15 years or so. And this gave them an incredible opportunity to have a very solid collection to sort of back up, if you like, their interest in photography. So it seemed to me to be the perfect place to make sure this collection went to. I wanted to keep it in the UK. It was becoming too big, too expensive. People were lending books for me. I couldn't really deal with it. So it was much better that it went to an institution where they would do a proper inventory, which is now up and running on the Tate Britain Library. And people can go in and look at any book they request to view.
Yeah, all I can do is just take my hat off to you. What a magnificent collector story. I mean, really, you've achieved what most or many collectors dream about.
All right, thank you.
Well, and plus too, you know, these books that you've produced are beautiful in themselves, and what a wonderful guide for people who are just getting into it. Speaking about an interest in books as opposed to photography books, what aesthetic criteria did you use to select your books early on? Was it the quality of the photographs, or did it have something to do with the book itself? Was there a kind of a cross-pollination, or was it primarily the photographs?
Well, the first thing a memorable photographic book has to include are very strong pictures. And the strong pictures have to add up to making a point. There has to be a narrative. There has to be a real reason why they exist. And then, of course, you also look to the design and to the production values of the book to ensure that they echo the message that the book is trying to deliver, and all these things come together. So it isn't really one thing or the other. It's that miraculous combination where if you can get the great photos that really hit the nerve, and you can then add in the right kind of production values, the right kind of printing, doesn't necessarily mean it has to be the best quality. It just has to really echo what the book is trying to achieve to do. And when all those criteria are reached, then you have a very good photographic book. So ultimately, though, it is down to the quality of the pictures. And what you look at, you know, I've mentioned already, there are many thousands of books published every year. You generally find that most of the books, when you look through them, the photographs aren't strong enough. So however great the design is, it'll never become something that is going to resonate and have a real impact on the viewer of the particular book.
Okay, so the strength of the photograph, you used the word resonate. I've also heard you use the word energy a lot and fresh a lot.
Well, I think when you see an exhibition or a book that you really appreciate, you just get knocked out by it. You know, you don't even really, if you like, have to justify it or have to explain it. Right. Just something hits you. Something resonates in you that makes you really appreciate that viewpoint the photographer is trying to put across. And this is something that's incredibly difficult to do. You know, to actually achieve a sort of vision as a photographer doesn't happen naturally. And most photographers won't actually get that far, whereby you can look at a photographer's image and say, yes, that's a Nan Goldin, that's a William Eggleston, whoever it is. And that's a very difficult thing to do. So then when you put those images into a book, then it really starts to work. And even the greatest photographers, when you come to the crunch, they probably only have that one or two, if you're very lucky, two books that actually, are the things that they're going to get out when they get to the pearly gates and they're asked, what did you achieve in this life? Now, I've done over 100 books, and I'm certainly not going to tell you that most of my books are brilliant. You know, I can pick out a couple, but not that many, because it's very difficult to get everything right. And thank God for that. Otherwise, we wouldn't know where to look, because we'd be drowning in photographs and drowning in novels or whatever other genre of book you choose to look at.
Well, it's like great poets. I mean, even the very, very greatest only have a handful that stand the test of time, typically.
No, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And thank God for that, I say.
Okay. So what one or two books out of your 100 have achieved this? And what is it that you're proudest of them, or you just think everything's right? So what does that mean?
Well, I would probably pick out The Last Resort, which is a book that was originally published in 1986. And it's the first time I moved from being a black and white photographer. Back in the 1970s, if you were a serious photographer, you know, you're almost obliged to work in black and white. Color was the domain of snapshot photography, commercial photography. So it's very exciting for me to see these photographers, particularly in America, like Eggleston, Stephen Shaw, develop and have museum shows of their color images. So I decided to move to colour in the early 80s. And the first project I did was about this rundown seaside resort. And this is a book that I actually self-published. It only had 40 pictures in, and it's now on its something like its ninth reprint. So it's been in print ever since 1986. So yes, if there's one book that I would pick out, that would be it.
And did you work with a designer?
Indeed, I hired a designer. And of course, now the actual first edition of this book would be quite sought after and have quite a premium on it price-wise. As you know, this is what happens in the photographic publishing world and the publishing world in general.
Yes, of course. The way it was first introduced to the world, or the item that was first introduced to the world, can be world-changing. So that's why, I guess, one reason why it's important. That was a question of mine, actually. Are first editions similarly important to the photography book collectors?
Totally, yeah. I mean, you've got to have the first edition, really. It is indeed much like that world of novels. The first edition is the one. And preferably in perfect condition and ideally signed as well. Even better, signed to a fellow photographer, fellow writer, fellow editor, someone of some note.
Yeah, association copy, yeah.
Yes.
Just getting back to the way that photographs were displayed, and that is through exhibitions. Would you say that curators were reluctant to display books because they wanted to focus not on the books, but on themselves as the organizers of the way that photographs were displayed?
Well, it's an interesting point. So the first thing to say is, for example, one reason why the Japanese market produced such amazing books in the 60s and 70s, there's a lot of photographers out there and there weren't any galleries to speak of. So the only way you could get your work out was to actually publish it.
Yeah.
But that meant that the publishing market there became as important, in fact, if not more so, than the actual ability to do exhibitions because there were no slots. In the UK and in other places now, I think if you go to a major show of a photographer, it'd be very rare now. You wouldn't see a vitrine full of books, magazines, first editions, ephemera. And these really help to bring the exhibition alive because you have the images on the wall, but we all want to know a bit more about what the photographer is thinking, and a vitrine and knowing that the books are there that they've published and the magazines they've been included in, and even letters and all kinds of ephemera really add something. So in this day and age, this is something that wouldn't happen 20 years ago. It's very rare you see a major show without vitrines backing up, if you like, the work that's on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, it's a way for the photographer to tell their story directly to their followers, as opposed to having an intervention of a curator. The book is.
Well, indeed, but you know, you still need a curator. And if you like, a book has a curator, often known as the editor. And that's often, more usually than not, someone apart from the photographer.
Yeah. I mean,
you wouldn't actually trust photographers to do, I guess, their own editing. I mean, many do, but I think it's always good. And for example, in my case, it's very good to bounce ideas around with the designer, the editor, and to ensure that we get to make the most clear statement in the book that is humanly possible.
Would you say that you're primarily responsible for the book now being the main vehicle for displaying photographers' work?
And I would say I'm not responsible for that. I would say I'm one of many that have added to that sort of whole debate and that whole conundrum and whole reassessment of the status of the photography book. But there are many other people, Andrew Roth, etc., that have achieved many things on that front. So I'm in denial of your statement there.
Okay. I don't think you can deny that you've certainly...
Probably did, yes, but not the main voice.
I think in terms of validating the photo book, you've been pretty influential.
Well, thank you, Nigel.
I just want to get into, again, I guess we touched on the fact that what makes you pull the trigger on a book is... What, this wow factor?
Yes, the wow factor and the good photographs, the strong statement, the production that echoes and amplifies the message of the book, all these things coming together.
What's a good photograph?
Well, that's a very difficult thing to actually know, but it, you know, it sort of touches a nerve. You know, there's a story within a story, if you like. I mean, if I knew how to take a good photograph and to write down the formula, I would do that and become a very wealthy person. But as you well know, in any creative genre, it's an impossible thing to define, but you know it when you see it.
Well, again, you with all of your experience and your passion, that's the question, isn't it? Like, I go out and have a look at a photograph and I think, wow, I love that. You might think it's a crappy photograph.
Well, that's a possibility. I haven't had the pleasures of inspecting your folio of work, Nigel, but you don't want to see my creative writing. You know, it's not very good. I'm happy to have found one thing I can do reasonably well.
Well, it's a, you know, one of the tenets of a good collector is to focus. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm going to get into this shortly about the work that you've done with the photo books that you have. In other words, sort of categorizing and thinking hard about how they differ and why they were produced. And again, this is all something that a good collector does and spends a lot of time on.
Sorry, was that a question? It's more like a statement.
It was a statement. You can ring in on it or you could just leave it sit. It's up to you.
I have to remember, such is the depth of my collecting gene, that, you know, not only do I collect books, but I also collect prints, but also I collect wacky things like space dog ephemera. You know, I've just done a book, for example, around that subject. So there are other things that intrigue me and things that I've gone out and to collect. The books is my most serious one. There are other genres out there, which I've also dipped my toe into.
Well, I love the fact that you collect prostitutes' cards with photographs on them in phone booths. So that's
yeah. Well, that collection's really died because they're no longer out there. You know, everything's on the internet now. So that's come to a natural end.
How did you go after those? Like, did you find the stores that had them, or did you actually go to the telephone booths?
Absolutely, go to the telephone booth and then take them out. You have to take them out the blue tack and put them in your pocket. I'm sure many people thought I was a dirty old man when I was roaming the phone booths of London and Bristol.
You realize that you're cutting their business too. That's kind of a sad story.
Yes, that is a possibility. But, you know, I wouldn't take it if I had it before, remember? So once I've got one, I'm not going to take every one. I don't believe in swaps.
Now, okay, I've got a question here. In terms of someone who's just starting out thinking, yeah, okay, I'd like to collect photography books. Now, I can't collect everything, but I'm going to use me as a, for instance, because I get free advice from you. I have a collection of publishers' histories and ephemera around publishers. So I'm thinking, okay, I'd like to collect books with photographs of publishers in them. Maybe that's too limited, so I go with publishers or authors, author photographers. So have you come across anything like that?
So what do you mean? I mean, there are smaller publishing houses that often do very good quality books.
I'm interested in going after photography books full of photographs of authors and anyone connected with books and publishing.
Okay. Well, there are quite a few books like that. I mean, I wouldn't know them. I wouldn't be able to tell you the names off the top of my hat, but you know, many photographers have photographed the likes of different poets and authors and such like, and photographers and artists. You know, I'd be hard pushed to tell you which is the prime example of that genre without studying them more carefully. I don't think in the end any of those particular types of books made it into our reference book, because we're looking at photographers to make a statement about their relationship to the world, if you like, rather than a collection of portraits of famous people.
Why didn't you do that?
Well, we're going on what we think makes a very strong book.
And portraits don't?
No, we have many portrait books, but they wouldn't be particularly of portraits of famous people. I mean, there are many of those books around, as I say, and I don't think any of them of any significance went into our book, but there are plenty of books that we did include of portraits.
And that's because they made a strong statement about what?
About that particular genre of person that they were documenting, their relationship to them. I mean, the danger with portraits of famous people, this is what we see in magazines all the time. So it's a very well-explored genre. So we're looking at people who did, like August Sandow, who did these amazing pictures in the 1920s in Germany. We're looking at people that really sort of made huge contributions to the whole genre of portraiture through photography.
Okay. And
it's not particularly celebrity portraiture.
No. Well, I guess as far as a photo book goes for the photographer, it's a way of solidifying their legacy, would you say?
Well, you will never meet a photographer that doesn't want to have a book published, because the great thing about a book is they're there forever. You know, exhibitions come and go, magazines come and go, a book is there. And, you know, we never throw books away. They may end up in a secondhand bookshop or remaindered, but they're still out there. So indeed, it is very much part of their legacy that they're building on. And it's the ultimate way for a photographer to make a statement.
Yeah.
Because they control the length, the images, the sequence, the production values, all those things that make up a good book.
Well, it's also a great way to learn about other photographers, isn't it?
Well, totally, of course. Yeah. And that's, if you're a photographer, you need to learn about what's been achieved by other photographers to see and to help you understand what's possible for yourself. You then, if you like, steal their ideas and make them into your own, which I'm sure happens in all the creative.
It does, yeah. Fields. There are not too many new ideas out there. I noticed you referencing the book just looks delightful too. And in fact, a friend of mine specializes in antiquarian and modern books about cooking. He's an antiquarian bookseller, well-regarded. Don Lindgren is his name. Anyway, you referenced a book called The Book of Bread by Owen Simmons, 1903.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was looking at your presentation of it, and it really does look modern, doesn't it?
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's one of those freak books that you're totally right. It could have been published 100 years later and no one would know the difference. And did your friend know about this book?
Well, yes, I went searching for it. And he, of course, has a copy of it for sale.
Very good. Quite a pricey book these days.
Yes. And he was a baker, right?
He was, yes.
Why'd you pick that book?
We just liked the books, the photos in the book and the directness of it and the sort of simplicity and naivety of it all. I mean, here's someone that was passionate about baking.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have the subject matter to make a good book. And what better example than someone celebrating the different types of loaves that they bake?
Well, it's so modern too, isn't it? It's such a lots of people, particularly during the pandemic, are making their own bread.
Mm-hmm.
So your studies, your three books, basically kind of take a different slices at the pie. One is chronological. So early on, you look at Walker Evans because he was very influential, being both objective and subjective at the same time. Could you expand on that?
Well, I think Walker Evans is one of the great photographers of the 20th century, and his ability just to sort of show things as they are, but make very meaningful and beautiful pictures. So he understood the value of the documentary photograph and how to make the most of that. And therefore, was a huge influence on other, a whole generation of other art photographers that have learned a lot from Walker Evans. I mean, that we all have, you know, he's one of these figures we all keep coming back to and therefore his books have been incredibly influential on the world of photography. And of course, his books are the best way to find out his pictures, because we'll have all missed the 1939 Museum of Modern Art show.
So what's the number one takeaway from his book?
Just the value of good, clear documentation of the subject in front of you, but with that sort of personal connection that is so important.
I don't understand.
It's very difficult to explain. I mean, we almost need to see the pictures to understand what I'm talking about. And you can see why I'm a photographer, not a writer, because I can't really, I can't really find the words that perfectly express that whole meaning.
It's interesting. That's why I tend to interview writers as opposed to artists.
They're more articulate, you mean?
Well, yes, they thought things through with words as opposed to images. Okay, so you are on an ongoing search to find and unearth the most, quote, important books.
Well, I think the search now has somewhat calmed down for me, because I feel in the world of photo books, you know, I've done my contribution. And what you haven't acknowledged is I also did a book about Chinese photo books, and helped very much with the book that Horacio Fernandez did on Latin American photo books. So there are other genres that we also explored. But the foundation here, as you've already mentioned in your introduction, really specializes in the work of British photographers. So I've really made it my job to try and explore that more thoroughly, and to find every book of any significance by British photographers or about Britain in the last, particularly since, say, post-war. So if you like, I've narrowed down my collecting. We still have a good collection of international books here, because after the books went to the Tate, I went and bought a library of a photographer who was just retiring from his college position and had to get rid of his books. So I bought that. So I basically was able to replace some of the lost gems that had gone to the Tate. But now other people will take up the search, if you like.
Sonny, I picture you browsing through the Kimboko district of Tokyo, mm-hmm. kind of just going crazy. Did that happen?
Oh, yeah, I went many times to Jimbosho. Yes, because Japan was one of the great pleasures of this whole collecting photographic book things and the surprises there. I think now pretty much all those great books from that period I was talking about have been discovered. But of course, there are always new books being published in Japan. It's still probably the biggest photographic book market on the planet. They must buy and sell and create more photo books there than anywhere else. So yes, I mean, the new collector, of course, their job is now to try and spot the gems of tomorrow as they come out today and get them at the initial asking price. That's the fun of the game, you know. But of course, what you have to do is be determined to pick out books that resonate to you rather than read the rest of the book lists.
That's the thing, isn't it? You've got to trust your own eye.
Of course, yeah, yeah. What else can you do?
Just want to go on to William Klein again, another hugely influential photo book on New York. Can you talk just a bit about that?
Indeed, you know, because, you know, Klein was, well, he's French and he was working in America, and he produced this book about New York, and it just had the energy that was quite remarkable. And the way he laid it out, the graphic graininess of these images, the stream of consciousness, if you like. So his book, New York, which was published in 1959, was one of the most influential photographic books ever published, because copies of this went to other territories, Latin America, Japan, these other places where they're interested in photography. And there's a whole next generation of photographers that, if you like, took the language of Klein and then adopted it to their own cities and to their own urban situations. And so, you know, that's really the best kind of flattery you could ever have for a book's achievement, is to see people copying it.
And exactly what did they copy?
Well, the very strong graphics that this book included, not only in terms of the layout, but in terms of the black and white grainy pictures and the effect that they had on the on the photographs.
What about Dido?
Yes, well, Dido Moriyama is another great photographer. He emerged in the 70s, late 60s, and is still going strong, even though he's over 85 now, I think, or 80 anyway. And he has a particular language. And again, it's this very black and white, contrasty, grainy. And he, for example, he also took up the language of Klein and combined it with Andy Warhol's famous exhibition from the Moderna Museum in the 70s. And this, if you like, started him off. And he's now got his own language, if you like, which other people copy. So you can see how the enthusiasm and the language is passed on from one photography generation to the next.
And that's what your books do.
Well, we very much trace these links and bring together different photographers and try and show their connection and how they've all learned from each other. So yes, that's indeed part of the history of the photo book that we uncover in these pages.
Yeah, I think the other thing too that's so impressive is how you've worked to classify these books. So, you know, talking about Japan in the 60s and 70s, you suggest it's their anger over Hiroshima and the American presence that what propelled them into these protest books.
Absolutely. It was that incentive of the anger that built up about the bomb and the American presence still being there in places like Okinawa, which manifested itself very effectively in these photographic books. So, you know, all books have to have meaning, remember? And when you've got an incentive like that to help you along,
yeah,
it does often mean, you know, you've got a head start and you've got a reason why you want to make this body of work.
Yeah, I think it's like any really powerful piece of writing. If you have a red hot incentive or anger in this case to say something, obviously it comes through in the words, but this anger must come through in the photographs too. And that's what really grabs you. Is that it?
Totally, yeah. No, you describe it very well. And you're absolutely right. I'm sure the same applies to other writers as well.
Yeah, when you've got a really powerful incentive to communicate, that really helps with the end product.
Agreed. Coming up with more statements, Nigel, and not questions. Yeah, you obviously learn very fast here.
That's my style, Martin. You know that interviewers have style, different styles.
Oh, don't worry. I've done many interviews over my career. I study them. I mean, you can see on YouTube, there's a whole series of interviews I've done with other photographers on the Martin Parr Foundation YouTube channel. But of course, I'm interviewed a lot more than probably I interview other people.
Okay, so what's the best piece of advice you've got for an interviewer then? Don't make statements?
Yes, that's a start. But also try and ask something, you know, because most interviewers just look at the questions that other people have asked and re-ask them. As an observer of, you know, being interviewed many times, that's the thing I would come up with.
I've got three or four really good, in my own opinion, podcasts with great author interviewers that you may or may not want to listen to.
Okay.
Getting back to the Japanese, the photographers actually talking about their anger, they also captured the anger of student demonstrators. So they had a subject too, obviously.
Yes, no, totally. It worked on both things, you know, both on the American presence and indeed the protests that were going on, which were around things like the building of the airport, which was highly contentious at the time. And of course, things like anti-Vietnam protests, anything, you know, as you know, 60s were the decade of protests. And so there was plenty of material out there. And the Japanese photographers are able to capture that energy of the streets and the anger on the streets much more effectively, I would say, than maybe the European people who are also photographing the protests of 68 in particular, I guess.
Yeah, in Paris. What is stream of consciousness photography?
It's almost where it touches an emotion. You know, you see it and you try and find pictures that touch on that. So, you know, it's like a dream world that you're creating out of the reality. I mean, photographs are interpretation of what's going on in front of us. And so, you know, it's as much to do with the stream of thinking as, you know, the narrative's still there because photographs got to be of something. But that's just a term that is used a lot in photography. And it's quite difficult for me to explain to someone who doesn't know about photography precisely what it is. But I'm doing my best, not doing particularly well.
Yeah, I appreciate the effort. I mean, we, you know, as far as books are concerned and literature, James Joyce and Virginia Woolf come to mind.
As stream of consciousness writers.
Yeah.
I haven't read James Joyce. It's too complicated for me. I don't read novels, remember. Only photographic ones.
What about graphic novels? You like those?
No, not really. I just love photography.
Okay, what about the conceptual style? Ed Ruscha.
Well, yes. Okay, so Ed Ruscha, you know, was one of the people that contributed to this whole new way of looking at the world through an analysis, through a dryness, through, you know, the typographies that he created. So yeah, it just became a different way of looking and thinking about the world. And him and Hans-Peter Feldman probably are the pioneers of that way of thinking. And, you know, his books became hugely influential too. And it's interesting, you know, he didn't come from the world of photography. He was a fine artist that then, you know, used photography and made these, you know, quite remarkable books. And many of these were self-published and quite humble, but had a huge resonance in that world. It took many years for people to finally appreciate how good they were. You know, when they first came out, no one was much interested. But 10, 20 years later, people understood how significant they were.
Was this the string of garage stations along Sunset Boulevard or something?
Exactly, yeah. Every house on Sunset Strip, swimming pools. He did about 10 of these different books.
What about the Provoke movement?
Well, Provoke was a magazine in Japan that was published in the late 60s, early 70s. And the idea of Provoke was to try and understand and look at the previous generations of photographers and to say that they were too conservative and they wanted to try and install a different sort of mentality and a different way of thinking about photography. The magazine was called Provoke, and people like Daido Moriyama were members of the group Provoke. And therefore, we think of that whole period of time in Japanese photography as being the Provoke period. So one magazine only had 4 issues, in fact, to find a whole movement.
Can you tighten up on that a little bit? Like, what did they do?
You know, I'm a bit rusty now, Nigel. It's a long time since I've thought about this.
Sure, okay.
You know, they just try to refresh the language. The Bye-Bye Photography by Daido was one of the defining books of that whole time. And he scratched his negatives. He put dirt on them. He gave an energy into the photographs that was very difficult to really understand. And so it's quite anarchic. And at the same time, after he did the book, he threw all the negatives away and just left it. So, you know, it's almost like punk in its approach. And now when you look at the book and you look through it, you know, it still has that incredible energy.
That reminds me of, I'm trying to remember, it's one of the fine press proprietors back at the turn of the 20th century who threw his fonts, his type into the Thames.
Yeah, similar idea, yeah.
There's also an interesting publication called Evidence that provided you with an appreciation of vernacular photography.
Yeah, well, vernacular photography is the work done not by authors, but if you like, by someone who's doing a basic, like a day job, if you like. So you take a photograph because it has a purpose, like an estate agent or something like that. And in this particular case, these are photographs done by different scientific institutions in America, and they were done to illustrate experiments. And when you put these photographs out of context with no particular text to explain them, they become the strangest, weirdest set of photographs, but incredibly effective. And the thing that shocked everyone when this book came out in the late 70s, I think it was, is that it wasn't by an author. So the author became the actual editors of the actual images. And they'd gone around to these different institutions looking for these pictures and accumulating them, putting them all together.
So really, it was just sort of this idea by a few editors who, as you say, pulled together anonymous.
Yeah, they were two photographers.
Right.
And they did this part of their work.
Yeah.
And it became an iconic book within that genre.
Yeah, and it's funny, you talk about vernacular stuff. That's a growing field in antiquarian books and ephemera. You know, it's things like photo albums by just regular people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can find some very great pictures, because, you know, if you think the purpose of a photograph is to make a statement about something, this is what people, if you like, were doing.
Yes.
That's why they can be so effective.
Yeah. They're trying to make sense of their world in a way.
That's right. Yeah.
Or record it. I like the mention of Goldblatt, is his name?
David Goldblatt.
In Booksburg.
Yes.
And this whole idea of once blacks got the vote, he decided to change his photography from black and white to color. I thought that was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Was that an important book?
Yeah, I know Goldblatt's one of the key photographers of the 20th century, and In Boxburg is one of the key books. And yes, you're absolutely right. He, you know, when the boats were, he changed to color and did color landscapes and urban landscapes very effectively as well. He's recently just died about 2 years ago, sadly.
Oh. Propaganda books, the relationship between politics and photography. What are some of the key books in that field?
I guess when we look back on the history of photography, you know, the ones that really stand out are the Russian constructivist books done by the designers like Lissitzky and Rodchenko, where the sense of design, the productions were quite remarkable. The budgets were, completely unlimited, so they could do anything. And they produced the most remarkable books, you know, as a shape and form of propaganda. And then you have other periods, Nazi Germany, of course, fascist Italy, and smaller ones as well, like even Angola or anywhere where there's propaganda books from Libya. They're all propaganda books. And that's a fascinating genre in itself. And it's something we looked into in our history of photo books.
Just finally then, I know that your colleague, Mr. Badger, blames the French for this, the existentialist movement, towards a sort of personal interpretation of a personal style, you know, as opposed to photographing the war, it's me embedded in the army and my experience of that war. That and the explosion of color, would you say that defines the last 20 years or so?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that we first started taking color seriously in the 70s. And now in the 80s, for example, in the UK, where I was working, I became a color photographer myself. And then it was a big novelty to work in color. Now, if you go to an exhibition or you look at a new book, if it's in black and white color, no one bats an eyelid. You know, so again, it just demonstrates very effectively how subjective these histories are and how the acceptance of color is now totally not an issue, not a problem whatsoever. So yes, on the color front, what was the other question about the, I don't see what this has got to do with the French particularly.
Well, the existentialist view of the world that we're responsible for our own lives and that it's us that determine what happens to us.
I guess you can find that tendency in France and all over the place, really, can't you?
Yes, that's the point I'm getting at, is that this it's affected the way that photographers have emphasized their personal style rather than trying to document the world.
Well, I think you can do both. You know, I mean, I don't think you have to choose one or the other.
Okay.
I mean, I think the thing a photographer has to define, if you like, is their relationship to the world, which is entirely unique. And that's, if you like, the thing that we're trying to express, that ultimate connection that we have. And that connection ultimately becomes the subject matter rather than the subject itself.
Finally, your advice to someone who's gotten all excited about photography books because of our conversation.
Well, I suppose the first thing to do, and this is what I have to say, you have to read our three volumes. If you really want that, sorry about that. But, you know, if you ask me a question, what else can I say? That'll give you a very good grounding in the history of photo books and how they've evolved over the years. And then the other thing is to go to, a library, a bookshop, ideally maybe a photo book fair. Look at the books and go around and find the ones that really resonate something to you. And they are, if you like, the ones that you should buy. I mean, I think you've got to respect the past, so you can try and find the classics. And many of the important books from, say, Eggleston's Guide to Robert Frank's America, The Americans, have been republished. So you get an opportunity to buy them without having to spend the exorbitant price you'd spend for a first edition. And then complement it with contemporary books. That's the exciting thing, is you have the chance to actually go and buy them at their basic price.
What, in your opinion, are the books that are going to go up in price, finally?
I'm not going to tell you that. That's a really unfair question, Nigel. But I guess, you know, if you look at the lists, and I contribute to these lists as well, as people do the best books of the year, that's a good starting point. I mean, you have photo booksellers like Photo Eye in America, who are the biggest online sellers. You know, they do a daily bulletin, in fact, so that's a good place to start.
What's that called again?
Photo Eye.
E-Y-E?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for lending me your voice, if not your eye.
Okay.
This was most educational, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Martin Parr is... Maybe you could tell me what you're doing right now.
I'm in the foundation, and about to go home and make some chicken soup. How about that?
Just an ordinary guy.
Yes.
Okay, thanks again.
Okay, cheers.
Bye-bye.